We record Dungeons and Dragons.
I am a dragon.
I am a dungeon. Jinx, yo me a Coke.
We're going to be bringing the energy today, I think.
Well, I was kind of waiting for the punch in of the intro and I didn't hear it. And I'm like, are you doing it? Or is it just going in post?
Oh, I haven't done it yet. I was waiting for something funny. The dungeon thing wasn't funny.
Well, I mean, like, come on. Like, the bar for us being funny is pretty low.
Start the game already!
I'm pretty sure that the bar for us being funny is actually the bottom rung of a portcullis when it's closed. So I have a surprise for you.
You're drinking cider? Oh.
It's not open. So I just showed Shane a bone shaker. I am not actually drinking a bone shaker. I will drink the bone shaker if we go over time. So please, God, let this episode be a short one. I actually have almost the last of my gin and tonic with just a splash of cranberry in it, which is really quite nice.
See, even thinking about Bone Shaker is going to spoil my Summersby cider.
We had some friends come up and stay with us, and he brought Bone Shaker. He really likes it. And I'm like, man, Bone Shaker is so bad. And he's like, I like it. It's, you know, it's got a nice, strong flavor. And I'm like, yes, it does. And he's like, it's, you know, and it's a strong beer, which is, you know, I really enjoy. And I'm like, yes, it is.
Yeah.
And we're friends, so I'm not going to tell you what I really think, but man, Bone Shaker is bad beer.
I'm not a big beer drinker normally. I'm certainly not an IPA drinker. I've had Bone Shaker once, and I'm pretty sure I have, like, PTSD from it.
Here's the funny thing is that I actually do enjoy an IPA, and I like beer, and I like money. So if you'd like, you can send me some beer, or you can send me some money. Or you can send me money to buy beer. Podbag at nerdingundertheinfluence.com. I'm sure there's a Venmo or something set up, right? In any case, I actually quite like a lot of IPAs. And Bone Shaker is just, it's just bad. I've said before, I don't know if I've said it on the podcast, that like some beers are good beers and then you add hops and it adds something. And some beers are just good with extra hops in them. And some beers are bad, and then they put a lot of hops in them to try and disguise the fact that they're just bad. So Bone Shaker has a lot of hops in it. I'll let you draw your own conclusions.
Stepping away from beer for a second, they say that there's two different types of tasters in the world. I'm sure there's a lot more. And we've had this conversation before, but it boils down to which side of the line of cilantro.
Yeah.
Right? Because cilantro legitimately tastes differently to different people. It isn't just like a preference thing, right? Like it is a...
Yes.
It's genetic. It's an actual... Yeah, it's an interpretation. It's a, you know, it's a chemical thing, whatever it is. I hate cilantro.
I love cilantro.
Which is why you probably... Not that, you know, they're all that similar.
Not necessarily related, but... Yeah,
but, you know, I find people that love cilantro also like IPAs.
I wonder if there could be something relative between cilantro and hops, because that's really the difference between like just regular old beer and IPAs, mm-hmm. right? Is that they're just got a little bit more hops in them. There are different kinds of hops as well, and the cheap ones are what they put in most IPAs. And I've had some beer that use different kinds of hops, and they do legitimately taste differently. So if you've tried an IPA and you hated it, go look for an IPA that has a different kind of hops in it. You might like it. You might not. It's worth a shot.
I had one Bone Shaker at work back in the days when we used to just grab some random craft and throw it in the fridge, bust it out on a Friday. And my response was basically like, why did somebody take this hops, soak it in pine tar and light it on fire? Because that's what it tasted like I was drinking. Like it was just, it wasn't bad. It was offensive.
That's an accurate depiction in my mind of what it actually tastes like. I haven't had one since because we did it. We on our first second failure to launch this podcast, I showed up at your office one night with a six pack of, oh, hey, this is interesting. I bought it literally because there's a skeleton on a bicycle on the can. Mm-hmm. And I had never had it. And I'm like, oh, okay, this might be neat. And I showed up with it there. And I think that's the last time I had any. And I think I drank two of them that night and the other four got thrown out. Or potentially left in your fridge, because that's what these are. These are ones that somebody left in my fridge. So
no. Not right. So what have you been up to?
I've been playing a little bit of Horizon Forbidden West. Yeah, I just looked at the hours played on my Steam account, and it's a big number for like a week. Maybe 2 weeks. Is it 2 weeks?
Coincidentally, I have also been playing some Horizon Forbidden West, so how about I row that stinger and we get into it?
Yes.
I used to be an adventurer like you.
Stay a while and listen.
I find it funny. Mm. We were both so excited about this game.
Yes.
And then you were like, oh, it's coming out and I'm going to get it for my birthday, but I'm going to, you know, it'll be bought for me early, but I won't be able to play it. Until my birthday, you were going to have to wait. When was your birthday?
April 12th. It's currently September 10th. So yeah, I did actually play it just a little bit before my birthday. I played through sort of the intro sequence and I was like, ah, and I was burnt out on Baldur's Gate at that point. And the control scheme for Horizon Forbidden West was just a little bit too much for me to go into at that time. I'm still a little bit upset with the way that the controls work. I find them a little bit clunky. Right, I'm playing mouse and keyboard. Are you playing mouse and keyboard or are you playing with a controller?
Mouse and keyboard.
I was wondering if it was better with a controller because it's like there's one of the things that I noticed about this game, and I'm jumping into this stream of consciousness style. One of the things I've noticed about this game is that there's a lot more combos that you can do. Like there's a lot more. If you press this key and that key in this situation, then this happens. And that's both good and bad. I mean, it's a little bit difficult to get into if you're trying to approach it reasonably casually, which I am. So I'm playing on easy mode for two reasons. Number one, I have a day job, so I cannot collect machine parts by shooting them off. So easy mode is sort of the first notch that you crank it down so that when you kill something, it retains all of its stuff. Unless you've specifically shot it off. In addition to that, I've noticed that there's not really a lot of telegraphing from the monsters or from the robots or whatever you want to call them, from the machines. So it's like, hey, I'm shooting acid at you. I can't dodge that. It's going to hit me. And now I'm stunned. And in the time that I'm stunned, the machine is charged. And between the machine charging and hitting me the next time, I just remain stunned. Like I'm just locked in stuns. So I have found that especially once you, when you start your hunting machines that are, you know, your level or a couple levels higher, your options are stealth or die. Mm-hmm. Not so much in easy mode. Like in easy mode, I'm fine with that. And I've found that like I'm enjoying this story enough because we've had this discussion before about difficulty level and just driving through things. And I'm finding that this story is big enough and dense enough that I'm actually almost thinking I don't care about, because in Zero Dawn I was like, I want to explore every marker on the map, I want to do every side quest, like everything that's here I'm going to explore the whole map in detail, and I'm going to like retread stuff a bunch of times because it was fun and interesting and I like climbing the mountains and jumping off of stuff. I do find myself in this game jumping off stuff and gliding just because it's fun. But in this game, I'm like, I kind of want to see what's next in the story. Now I'm doing a bunch of side quests, but I'm not doing that quest. I'm just going to go over here and see what's what. Mm-hmm. Right. Like I'm continually following something that someone has given me in dialogue.
So probably mild spoilers, I guess, from here on in discussion. I don't think either one of us are too far into the main storyline, but I do want to get your impressions. So,
okay. Yeah. Spoilers from here.
I know you've been kind of playing around the edges of the main story a little bit. So how far would you say?
Okay, so I'm past like the names of things. I'm past Barren Light. I have met with the sort of first tribe into the Forbidden West.
Okay.
So I have actually progressed through enough of the main quest that I have kind of my teeth in. So there's sort of three main forks of the story. And if you've gotten that far, you know what I mean. And if you haven't, then you probably don't. I will put it like this. I have found a backup of Gaia. I've gotten that far.
Okay.
And from there, the story forks sort of in three directions, and I've started down the path of that first fork.
Okay, I think you're actually at about the same spot that I am then, even though you've got like quadruple the playtime.
I have done a bunch of side questing.
I've done a fair amount of side questing too, but I've not done just a lot of like, I'm going to walk over that hill yet.
Right.
I've also been playing through on the easy difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of what I was looking forward to in this game was the story. And I'm also a little bit burnt out on the combat, not of this game specifically, but I am just coming off a large Assassin's Creed game and jumping into this. So there's some similarities in game style to be drawn there. And I wanted to fit this one in.
Yeah.
We talked about before the game released for PC, we talked about what we were looking forward to and how we wanted it to sort of follow up the first game as a sequel in terms of like not having to retcon a bunch of stuff and not lessening how that game ended and the climax that it came to. How have you felt about at least this far, how it's approached building off of that game?
I think it's neat. I like the way it's done it. I'm about 97% satisfied with how it did it. I really appreciate the idea that they didn't go, okay, we need a bigger space laser in the sky. It was just, okay, so you've gotten this far. And because you start off like in Zero Dawn, you start off as like an exile from a small village. Like you know nothing about the world, right? And through the course of that game, you discover a bunch of stuff about how the world works. And the fact that the world is quite a bit bigger than you thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
And this really expands on that with, okay, yeah, here's the Forbidden West. And then you find out that the Forbidden West is kind of like forbidden in quotation marks, right? It's like, well, it's forbidden, but that's really just a suggestion.
Yeah.
Right. And then the Forbidden West is just like this whole other world of people who do things differently. And I did find a thing, I forget where I first noticed this, but one of the things about like, especially like post-apocalyptic stuff, where it's like, everything is super dramatic, but at the same time, right? Like as you're walking along, you're hearing sort of the barks as they're called, of like just people saying things at random as you go by. And it's like, this is what like walking down the hall of a high school, right? People are just, and it makes sense because human beings, no matter where you go or what they're involved in, are the same and they're interested in the same stuff, right? It's like, I need to find a partner. I need to find some food. I need to find some shelter. And then I need to find some entertainment. So people are still talking about that stuff, you know, in spite of the fact that, okay, well, yeah, you know, we have to kill each other for a cob of corn. But at the same time, you know, did you see what Marcy was wearing last night to the campfire? Right? Like, oh my God, if I don't get to go to the senior prom with my spear, I'll die. So I do find the exploration of the human condition in a completely different setting and everyone is just the same to be kind of amusing. But I'm really enjoying it, and I think they expanded it in pretty much the only way it could have been good.
I'm on the fence, I think, a little bit more. I'm erring on the side of I kind of like the way they've handled it, but I feel like, at least what I've seen of it so far, like the Far Zenith stuff, mm-hmm. to me that feels like Space Laser.
A little bit, yes.
Now the question for me is, would not having that piece and just having, oh, we didn't go far enough or we didn't actually, you know, resolve things everywhere last time have been enough for this game to stand up on its own? And if it was just that, would it have sort of like retroactively lessened the ending a little bit too much? Because it does, in a way, it feels like, oh, you know, it isn't dampening my experience of the first game.
No.
You know, but it It's, oh, you thought you saved the world, my sweet summer child, you know? Yeah.
It's only step one. Your princess is in another castle.
Yeah. So maybe taking the Farzina stuff away would have made what remained felt a little bit too much like that. So I'm kind of on the fence, because to me it does feel like it feels out of place.
I have a slightly different take on the Farzina stuff specifically. I have a question for you. Like, have you had more than one interaction with the Far Zenith faction?
Not yet. No, I just had the one.
So I've only had the one as well. But the whole thing of that for me was just like, to me, that feels like, okay, this is, if you think about like Buffy or something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where it's like, okay, you have the villain of the episode, right? And that's kind of like, you know, terraforming the world and getting it back on track and, you know, resolving the storms and the blight. But you have the big bad of the season, which is the bad people from space, right? And I have a feeling, it's just a prediction at this point, that we're not going to see a lot, like we're not going to resolve anything with Far Zenith in this game. I think they're going to reserve that for the next game, or maybe the game after that. Because we have enough to do in Forbidden West to keep us. I mean, I've been busy for 60 hours and I'm still at the beginning, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, or maybe a third of the way through. Like there's still a lot of map left for me to look at. There has to be sort of an overarching, yeah, that we need to resolve this right now. But here's this unexplained thing. Here's an adventure hook for later.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it works for that.
I don't mind that kind of setup. I just found the limited sort of sampling that I have of it felt both out of place and a little tacked on. Now, maybe my opinion of that will change if I get more of that. And bear in mind, again, I'm only like maybe 17, 18 hours into the game kind of thing. I've opened up my base and I'm heading towards the first of the three in the fork.
Yes.
The lowest level of the three in the fork, the one that's appropriate to me. I'm just taking care of some side quest stuff around that before I continue there. So I'm coming at this from having only seen a small portion of the game so far, but that bit just isn't resonating with me yet. And I don't know that it's the concept. I think it's just the tone of it, the sort of hammy, very cartoonish.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that first combat encounter, like just the characterization of that character, you know, was off-putting. And sometimes that can be good and maybe that'll pay off. But it felt very
Jude Law in Ms. Marvel. No, not Ms. Marvel. Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
You know, like, don't use your powers and come at me mano e mano, and you can prove that you really are who you are. It really has that kind of vibe. And I don't mind that, honestly, because to me, it's just like, there's a few things in the game, like a few sort of, like Aloy will say something and I'm like, I don't know what you're looking at, Aloy, because I can't see it. It's like, oh, I have to jump up there. I'm like, what are you looking at? Right. So there's a delicate balance of how you telegraph things. And one of the things that needed to be telegraphed in that particular sequence was you cannot fight these people. You have to find another way to resolve whatever this is. And like for the first time ever, Aloy gets hurt. Like you have to like sit and recover for a while hurt, which to me was, oh, okay. Like I'm okay with that. Cause up until now, like Aloy is basically indestructible. No matter how many times I throw her off a cliff into lava, she keeps coming back. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's nice to get a reminder that yes, she's human. And yes, there's stuff out there that you cannot fight. I mean, you ended up the last game by basically taking down a space station on Earth, right? Cause that's what that big sort of bally Hephaestus thing was, you know, and you were casually killing robot Tyrannosaurus for parts. So having a sort of reality check of you're not actually superhuman.
Sure.
I do agree it was a little bit ham-fisted.
Like it to me, it came across a little bit more like Saturday morning cartoon villain rather than the thing that you would want to build up towards. Now, I've only interacted with one of those individuals at this point. I'm sure they're playing to, you know, the hubris and ego that humanity has developed over the, you know, millennia or however long it's been, whatever. Okay, fair enough. But you can do that without it feeling like cartoon villain. And so far, that's just my impression. It left just a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah, I feel very much like you're picking nits.
Oh, I'm definitely picking nits, but you know, unlike the quality of this podcast, the first game set such a high bar. That's the standard I'm holding the second to, right? So speaking of nits then, one of the things that you mentioned about a week ago, starting to make notes for this show, was that you thought that the voice acting was perhaps some of the best you'd ever heard in a game.
I will admit, because your response was basically, really? Because I thought it was,
I found almost everything before Baron Light, to me, felt incredibly bad. But that was the demarcation point. Like, it's almost like we built the game from this point forward, and then we realized we needed a bit of a prologue. So then we, you know, we filled it in with AI voices, or, you know, we called in the
B-list.
Yeah. Like, that's what that all felt like to me. I felt like I borderline thought some of it was AI-generated stuff.
Some of it probably is, to be honest. And a lot of the stuff, like the stuff before Baron Light, or the stuff up to sort of when you get past Baron Light, I did honestly just almost... The reason that I put that statement in there is because there is a heck of a contrast with some of the voice actors after Baron Light.
Oh, immediately. Like, when you hit that sort of...
the Marshall conversation?
Yeah, like that's where it picked up, right?
Yes.
I recognized one of the actors, first of all, played in not Exandria Unlimited Calamity, but sort of the follow-up to it that just happened, Downfall. He played in that crit role sort of spinoff. I can't remember his name all of a sudden. Anyway, I recognized the voice immediately because it was sort of fresh in my memory. The one guy that was not the leader at Baron Light, but sort of the second in command, the subordinate, the guy that survived at the end, black dude. The guy's voice sounds so incredibly familiar, but I couldn't place it.
Are you talking about Aloy's friend from home?
No. The guy was stationed at Baron Light. He was like the second in command. He
the guard for the diplomat guy? Is that who you're talking about? Or are you talking about the guy who? Because the guy who's running, the Karja who's running the place, is the guy who sort of sits behind his desk with the floppy hat.
Yeah, no, he dies, spoilers, he dies as you're wrapping up that thing. He dies, the priesty guy dies, and the guy that was sort of the second in command.
Oh, yeah, like the captain of the guard guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
From talking to him onwards... It was just like, oh, wow, the quality of the voice acting just, you know.
It did. And that's one of the reasons that I made that statement, is because the contrast between those two. Because I thought the stuff before Baron Light was just like, okay, it's just like video game voices. And they've got like whoever's in the office today doing the voice.
And normally you would get that when you're just doing like, you know, barks, right? Like the high school hallway conversation stuff. And I'm not judging it based on that. The... what was the name of that first town? The quality of the stuff that was going on there with sort of like the little mini village bad guy and some of the sort of prominent NPCs in there. I was just like, oh, wow, this is bad.
I didn't think it was bad, but I definitely, it did not flag as this is good. To me, it flagged as this is just mediocre video game voice stuff.
Well, it wasn't just bad. Like, you know, we watch Best of the Worst. You hear like, you know, B movie quality acting and stuff like that. And that's, you know, bad in a different way. this was the, and that's why I jumped to AI. It fell into that weird sort of uncanny valley of like, this is supposed to sound like a human being, but it sounds like a non-human being playing a human being, you know?
These people are all actually machines in human suits.
Yeah, it's like listening to Neil Breen speak, you know? It's
just yeah, like, fair enough.
You're using the right words and you know, you're pronouncing them the right way and the emphasis is mostly where it's supposed to be, but when you put it all together, it just, you know, it's not quite right in an unsettling way. But
have you met the one-armed marshal yet? It's after you meet the chief.
So no, I haven't gone there yet.
Okay.
I know who it is because he was at the thing and we saw him get his arm. Yeah.
Yes. You do meet that guy again, and it was actually his voice acting that prompted me to say that. Because it is really, really good. And it's subtle.
I think that's the one that's played by the actor that I was referring to that was in the Critical Role Downfall.
I only started watching Calamity. I sent you a Discord message as I was watching. I'm 2 minutes in and I'm like, oh, this is foreshadowing for absolute tragedy. Like it's coming in 5, 4. Yep, there it is.
Yep. But yes, and then, once I got past Baron Light, the combination of the guard captain or whatever he was, and then you go and meet Zoe. And again, I looked up her name on IMDb and it isn't one that I recognize, but it's like I've heard this voice a million times and it is so unique. You know, there's a cadence to it that feels so cloyingly familiar, but intentionally kind of like exotic and a little bit different, and I can't quite place it, but like it's been sort of banger after banger after that.
Yeah, it's the one of the things that I've been really impressed with in this game is the quality of there's a few glitches I've come across where like you'll run past the same person 5 times and they'll literally start their line before they finish the line the last time. I mean, the game is huge. You're going to find little bits and chunks of things that don't work right. But one of the things they've done really well is made the story feel like a living world a bit, right? Where there's, you'll do something and you're finished with the quest. But if you happen to run into that NPC as they've gotten home and you talk to them, they will say things to you about what has happened. In a way that feels really natural, right? Like, hey, thank you for saving me from such and such, and I'm here now and I'm doing this. And, you know, like I would never have been able to do that without you. And that's great. But the way that it's, scripted, the way that the actors actually say the things feels like how you would imagine someone would express that. So yeah, I'm really enjoying it and it feels huge.
So what do you think of it visually?
Well, I have to ask, what kind of settings are you playing it on?
I'm playing on a 1080p display, but I'm playing it at basically the highest settings. Okay. I think I've turned down, I'm not using ray tracing. I'm on a 4060. Didn't even notice if it had ray tracing options, but
I don't think it does.
I'm not using any DLSS stuff because when you're playing at 1080p, there's just not enough detail at lower resolution to really create a good 1080p, and I don't need it. Like, my frame rate's fine. I should be playing it at a higher resolution, but I just cheap and don't want to buy a new monitor.
Oh, no, totally fine. I was curious because I had some, there's some bugs with the, like, ultra-high settings, right? Yeah. Like, in theory, my system should handle that, but it doesn't.
Yeah, and I've found a few instances like of just general sort of frame pacing leg issues and like where the only thing I can really do is just close out of the game and restart it. And
I have a semi fix for that. When you go into settings, there's 2 options for full screen. There's full screen and exclusive full screen. Mm-hmm. And when you toggle between them, you have to apply those settings that will actually reset that frame rate thing.
Okay.
Most of the time for me anyway. But I tried it on ultra high. And like I say, I ran into like mostly just in cutscenes, like everywhere else, everything's fine. So I set it to high, and then I think I turned down the quality of shadows, and I turned the level of detail to one lower. Mm-hmm. I do have DLSS on. I'm playing it basically like 2K widescreen. And there's some things that I'm really, really super impressed with. Mm-hmm. I do find there's some areas that are a little bit dark, which is frustrating because like there's some places you go in and like Aloy turns on a flashlight and I'm like, this is great. And there's some places where it's like dark and I'm just like, I don't know what I'm looking at. Like turn on the flashlight.
Yeah. I found again, this, I don't know if it's a weird sort of uncanny valley type thing. The quality of the character artwork and the mocap and animation and faces and stuff like that, much improved from the first game. Like it was good in the first game. It is really good now. Not ultra realistic, but like in a comfortable place where it's realistic without feeling weird. Mm-hmm. It's almost everything else around it, like the foliage and scenery and stuff, the combination of like saturation and desaturation used in combination and just weird stuff going on that makes it all feel, and maybe intentionally, artificial to me. And I'm finding the sort of juxtaposition between the ultra realistic characters and the environment that feels cartoony isn't the right word, but you know, if you look at, and this isn't going to be a like apples kind of thing, it's a little apples and oranges, but if you look at sort of World of Warcraft when it launched, right, it never tried to be realistic. It was always sort of this slightly abstracted, not super cartoony, but like, you know, intentionally built to age a little bit well, wasn't going for ultra realism. And then as the expansions progressed, they leaned into that a little bit more. So the modern game, if anything, is slightly more cartoony than the original World of Warcraft was. Character models, you know, exaggeration of features, stuff like that. I kind of feel that way about the environmental detail in this one relative to how I remember the first game being. And it just feels a little bit disconnected. And this is mostly like exterior environment stuff. So maybe they did it intentionally. You think of watching the Avatar movies and you see sort of the environment detail there. Like they do it there to make it feel alien.
Right.
And sometimes I catch myself in environments here that to me feel alien.
Huh. I have not come across that. So I have a different. Do you have depth of field turned on?
I think I've backed it off a little bit.
I have
I definitely get rid of like most motion blur and stuff like that. I think I kept a little, like a little bit of bokeh, but I like to be able to, you know, especially in the cinematic moments, but I like to be able to see what's going on. Yeah, it's not, it hasn't been a big deal. Like, again, the minorest of nits to pick.
Right.
I don't remember feeling this way about the first game. And I don't know if it's just because I'm coming from playing an Assassin's Creed game where they really kind of push the realism in the environmental details, even a slightly older one like Assassin's Creed Origins, where this feels the most alien things about it, like the weird technology, the cauldrons, like that stuff all feels fine and basically how I remember it. It's walk around in the bush that just feels a little bit like combination of like some things are ultra saturated and some things feel oddly desaturated, but they're like both there at the same time, and is, I don't know. Now, I have not enabled any of the colorblind filters. I found that they weren't quite doing it for me, so I'm playing it normally, which means I'm struggling with seeing a couple of things, but that hasn't changed the environment to make it feel weird because I'm not using them. Anyway.
It's an interesting thing because I haven't noticed that. I have noticed that there is a slight difference in the realism of some stuff, right? It didn't really register with me, but now that you've said it, I'm like, oh yeah, okay. I've noticed a couple of places where like that tree really looks like a specific kind of tree. And then there's somewhere else where here's a plant that I don't recognize. And I'm pretty sure that I live in this biological zone. So I should.
Yeah. Meh. And I mean, they've chosen to, you know, introduce new stuff and, hey, it's a world in the far-flung future that's been recreated by machines. Spoiler alert for the first game. you know, and those machines haven't always been working optimally. So there's some things that are a little bit weird. That's totally fine. It's not so much the stuff that's intentionally weird that has been rubbing me the wrong way a little bit. It's the stuff that, like, supposed to feel normal, feels a little bit artificial. Do you remember playing the first Far Cry game when it came out? And it was like, oh, these graphics are absolutely amazing, but there was something about them that almost felt like gummy or plasticky. This is kind of like a lesser degree of that.
All of the plants felt like the artificial rubber tree in your grandmother's living room.
Yeah. Still looked more amazing at the time than, you know, anything that we'd seen, but something cloyingly artificial about it. Anyway, that's how I kind of felt about it here, but super minor nits. What killed me and my biggest nit, this is actually a legitimate axe to grind, is how unfortunate the default PC control scheme felt.
Yes.
The biggest thing, of course, was the double tap to dodge stuff, which I don't remember. I vaguely remember that being in the first game, but I don't think it was quite as...
It wasn't as sensitive.
You know, I'm like, I play games where, like, I normally I'll tap to sort of inch up on something, right? Mm-hmm. So I'll be, you know, in a cauldron where it's, I'm walking out on this rail and I want to get to the end of it before I make a jump. And it's like, tap. Oh, wait, no, I can get a little bit closer. Tap. Roll off of it. You're dead. Fuck.
Yes, I am grateful for the save points the game puts in for you, because I've done that too.
Oh, I bet you I've done that 30 times before I finally turn that off.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to have to rebind, like, where the dodge is now, because using, like, the left control just feels like a hard button to get to with the pinky finger to dodge it. I may remap some stuff so that I can throw it on Alt or something.
Yeah, but Alt is your walk key.
Yeah.
So now you got to remap that. That's my one major complaint with this game, is that it's obvious that it's a port to a PC, because it's like tap, 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 hold G, tap again, left alt control shift, tilde. Oh, you got the timing wrong. Start again.
Yeah.
And it's like, how many hands do you think I have?
And I don't remember that from the first game. And I know they've tried to introduce new mechanics to this game to sort of not only make it feel fresh, but keep pace with stuff that's come out in other games. So the combination of, like, the pull caster and the glider, for instance, right?
Yes.
Whereas one's like, you know, jump and then tap space again. And then the other one is jump and hold space again. And I've found myself fucking that up a little bit.
Oh, yes, a lot. I find myself jumping off of a pillcaster thing, going to glide, and it just sucks me right back into the pillcaster thing again.
You know, I think playing on the easy difficulty, I think I have, I'm not sure I have a legitimate death, like one that I earned. I had a weird sort of bugged death in the encounter where you drop the old shuttle on top of those, like, snake-like robot things. And you fight that one. I had one where I got glitched into some of the rubble and couldn't move.
Yes.
And then everything else has been combinations of, like, me jumping off of things that I didn't want to jump off of, rolling off of things that I didn't want to roll off of. Oh, I did blow a jump. I blew a jump once. One of the first tall necks that you get to, the one that you got to realign the satellite. Ish.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, man.
Yeah. I tried to, it was like, oh, I should wait for this thing to come around again, right? Because, like, mm-hmm. I see the point that I got to go to jump off of it, and it was like, oh, it's already there, pass it. Maybe if I rush, I can make it, and then, nope.
Ah!
Yeah.
Turn on your glider. Yeah. I have a reflexive thing now that when I jump, I hold down space. Yeah. But yeah, I've done similar things. Have you had to look anything up yet?
Yes, there was one thing that bugged me, and I think it boiled down to my colorblindness and not having colorblind mode on.
I'm not entirely certain that it did, because I've had to look up a couple of things where it's like, where the hell, like, I know what I need to do. I know where I need to get to, and I know what I should be looking for, but I can't find it. And I look it up and it's like, I'm going to sort of scroll through until I see the specific thing I'm looking for, because I don't want spoilers and I don't want someone to solve it for me. I just want to know that I'm not wasting my time here. And it's like, here's where it is. And I'm like, what? Where? And I'm looking at a screenshot of the thing that I need. And I'm still like, where?
Yeah, there was one, and it was a minor thing. So you, and this is before, before you actually move west, you have those people that were Shadow Karja that had gone all sort of spiritual with that one old man thing. And he had climbed up on the mountain to meditate or something.
Yes.
You speak to him. He's clearly dying. Then you're like, oh, I'm going to go get the lens or whatever it is
from the Stormbird
and come back. And I could not get onto the top level. And it's one of those ones that you have to kind of go around the whole sort of little plateau a couple of times. But there's just one climb point that I could not see. Like, I was looking right at it. I'm like, I can't see that. It wasn't something that was like, it was one of the little yellow posty things.
Yep.
But I just could not see it from any position that I found myself in. And when I tap my thing to tap V to scan for it, it wasn't showing up there from any position that I was in either. So I, after spending a solid 20 minutes just walking around the same, and it's a very, very little sort of plateau. Like it's a finger of rock sticking up in the air. Like, how the fuck do I get up to that top level? I see there's a thing over there that I can jump onto. I assume that's where it is. And I just couldn't see it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've run into a couple of things like that, and it's not, like, it's not often enough to be egregious. There's a couple of things where it's, you can't get there yet because you don't have the proper tool.
Yeah.
Right. But it keeps showing up in your quests and it keeps popping up as your default quest to, hey, like, go and get this thing. I'm like, I can't. It's covered in vines. I don't have the tool yet. And I get that that's sort of a, you know, come back to do these things later sort of mechanic. But the sort of ticking clock element of the whole story makes that seem like I should just ignore this. So that's a little bit annoying.
Yeah. And you run into this with a lot of games, you know, the balance between this is trying to create a sense of urgency versus, hey, do you want this cool armor? Let me give you a bunch of contracts to go, you know, kill a bunch of these random things and collect materials and
fetch quests. And they're always a thing. And I don't mind the fetch quests. I find that you have to do a little bit of suspension of disbelief in the story to say, like, hey, I know you said the whole world only has 3 months, but I'm going to screw off for a little bit and, you know, like upgrade my pouch for carrying berries. It's tough, like from a story development point of view, it's really tough to balance those things, right? Like on the one hand, you want to give people lots of stuff to do because the game is fun and you want to do these things. But at the same time, you have to give them a little bit of a reason to actually want to finish the main quest. How do you do that? I don't know. I don't think there's a good answer to that. Or at least nobody's found one yet.
Yeah. And the other minor gripe, and you know, this is probably boils down to playing it an easier difficulty, is that I find very little reason to bust out most of the tools.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like I tend to play most of it with the combination. You get a pretty good sharpshooter bow from one side quest chain and my main bow, and mostly it. Like I've busted out the spike thrower a little bit and I'm like, meh.
Yeah, I like it.
It isn't doing, and you know, even after throwing upgrades, that it isn't doing enough damage relative to what I'm already doing. So I'm at this point in the game, like it's mostly just I'm using acid as a counter when appropriate. I'll occasionally throw down like tripwires, but even then, very, very rarely. And it's mostly like I'm doing a lot of stealth. You know,
yeah,
I found too. Once I got that, especially when I'm like fighting against people, right? The tech is a little bit different, but like I've been going through clearing out some of the rebel forts, right? Mm-hmm. And being able to stealth, and like I've spent most of my points in like boosting my range damage from stealth and stuff like that. So I'm one-shotting a lot of people if I can stay hidden. So most of the challenge is just around staying hidden.
Yes, I've been playing that way as well. So I have like two main weapons I use. I now have a purple hunter's bow. So I have like five upgrades that are possible to it. And I think I'm on upgrade number two. And there's a whole bunch of side quests, of course, for stuff that I have to gather to upgrade that now. But there's that, and there's, I think it's the hard shot sharpshooter bow. Like once you upgrade it, because I think you're probably using Ku's bow.
Yes.
It's the green one. Yeah, which is good until the hard shot gets one upgrade. Once you upgrade that once, it's suddenly like much better.
And I don't have that one yet, I don't think.
Oh, you don't? It's a merchant bow, I think.
Yeah, I haven't bought anything yet from a merchant.
Ah, okay. In that case, that's probably the best bow you're going to find for a while. I think, and it's good.
I will go back and sort of buy some stuff from some merchants. I haven't sort of hit the limits of the stuff that I've been using. Once I do that.
You probably won't. So there's like the hunter bow, and the one I've got now has three different types of ammo. So I've got regular arrows and advanced arrows, which are basically just like slightly more damage and a little more expensive to make. And then I've got, is it acid arrows? I think it's either, it's fire arrows. So I have regular arrows. I have precision arrows, and then I have fire arrows. And then I've got the sharpshooter bow, which has regular ammo and like the air blaster ammo that tears parts off, right? Which I almost never use. And then I have my rope caster, but it's crap compared, especially in the first game. It was like your whole strategy is rope the thing, critical strike, back off, shoot him until he breaks the ropes, rope him again, critical strike, rinse, repeat. This time the rope actually doesn't do much until you get a better one, which is like 2/3 of the way through the game, I guess, according to rumor. So it's literally just like shoot it from stealth. Or like do silent strike, which I've upgraded like to the nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have like two slingshots. One of them is explosive and the other one's freeze. That's it.
Yep.
Right. And most of the time it's hunter bow.
Yeah. And I've not been using that much either.
Yeah.
Occasionally use it as an opener, but
yeah. Have you experimented with the Hi-Li glove? It's like a scoopy, it's like a spike thrower, but it throws out like a little disc thing that does a whole lot of, I forget what they call it when you detach stuff, but it's a specific kind of damage. But the shtick is that you throw it, after it hits, it comes back. And if you catch it and throw it again, it does more damage. Mm-hmm. And then if you catch it again and throw it again, it does more damage again. And I found that the mini game of trying to catch it was counterproductive, because by the time that I throw it and catch it, I could have fired 300 bow arrows and just killed it.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I don't have that yet. So
yeah, somebody gives it to you at some point for some side quest, I think. And then there's like merchants sell them all over the place. You might enjoy it. You might not. I don't know. I just found that it's like, I'm already not good at like Twitch style mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just like another level of Twitch that I'm not good at. And I'm like, meh. It's probably awesome if you're good at it. I'm not good at it, so I'll just leave it.
So despite all the minor nits, I do have to say I'm really, really enjoying the game. Highly recommend it. The first one was great. You have to play the first one for this one to make any sense. It's not a sequel that you can kind of just walk into.
I think you probably could, but it's going to have an awful lot of those. I don't really understand what's happening. I'm not sure why this is.
You're not doing
no
the game or your own experience any justice by trying to do it. So if you haven't played the first game, play it, because it's great. And it's available on PlayStation PC. This one is now available PlayStation and PC as well. So early assessment, you know, like what am I probably 10% of the way through the game, 15% of the way maybe through the main story, and it's pretty good. Maybe I'll say something different in a couple weeks next time we record, but for now, promising. I don't know why it took us so long to get around to playing it.
In my case, it was just burnout. I almost didn't play any video games for like 3 months. And then you mentioned you were going to start playing it. I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'll hop into it and see. And then it was like, oh, geez, why is the sun coming up? It's that kind of game.
So speaking of burnout, something happened this weekend that I didn't think was ever going to happen. I had the itch to play some World of Warcraft again. Asterisks. Lots of asterisks. I have no desire to play sort of the modern retail current expansion game. I'm interested to see where they go. The main Warcraft guy, Chris Metzen, left Blizzard quite a while ago. Started his own company where he was actually doing like board game, role-playing game kind of stuff, and then eventually came back as a lot of the winds were changing around the Microsoft acquisition. Bobby Kotick was being given a lot of money and then shown the door due to his stake in the company. And he came back, and he's the main guy responsible for the creative direction of Warcraft now, which includes this new sort of trilogy of expansions that they've got going on. It's not just here's an expansion. It's here's three planned expansions that are all going to sort of tie into each other. So I'm interested to see where that goes, because I will admit that I found the last few expansions that I played not my Warcraft, you know, and that's okay. There was an audience for it. They need to adapt and evolve if they're going to stay relevant. And by doing that, they're going to lose some people like me. That's totally fine. I wasn't a big fan of the tone of like Mists of Pandaria. The sort of panda thing had zero appeal for me. But like mechanically, that was a fantastic expansion. And it's what I would consider to be the last good one.
I started playing during Mists of Pandaria.
Yeah.
The first time I actually took the game seriously. I mean, I say seriously. I did some group stuff, but I mostly played solo. I really liked the panda themed stuff. I thought it was nifty. I thought the animation was awesome.
Oh, it was what it was. I just found it, you know,
very different, I'm sure.
If EverQuest had have decided, oh, we're going to be Kung Fu Panda now, like that would have, as a person who'd been playing the game for a long time. Now, I know, actually,
they did do it, but they did it with space kittens. So,
yes, you know, that would have felt at the time a little bit like jumping the shark. But I got over that. I actually loved the expansion. I didn't mind, like, I want to be clear in saying this, the Chinese overtones of the game and the some of the sort of melding of like Chinese and Japanese sort of cultural stuff, I really liked. It was really just boiled down to the panda thing that was just like, not really for me, and that's fine. But I enjoyed the expansion as a whole.
I identify as roly-poly, so it really did fit for me.
Oh, and, you know, it actually fit for me too, I'm sure.
I get what you mean, though, because it is very much a departure from it's like, I'm an orc, I'm a troll, I'm a panda.
I found everything that came after it. Like, I would have rather had more of that if it meant shit that I cared about, but like Legion, Warlords of Draenor, Battle for Azeroth, like each one of those felt successively just like I lost interest in them. There were times during, I think, most of those where I let my sub lapse and then sort of resub to play the new expansion. I did not play Shadowlands day one when that expansion dropped, and never played Dragonflight, the last expansion. It's the first expansion I've never played. And whatever the new one is, War Within, I don't know that I'm going to play it. So it's a weird thing, because I had the itch, and it's like, well, I'm not going to play the current game, because to me, that's not World of Warcraft anymore. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, maybe it's different enough that like it realigns with my idea of what WoW should be. But I'm not going to hold my breath. And I don't have enough time to play Classic. So where I'm kind of at is that I spent like a lot of my playing career actually playing on private servers. Not some of the gimmicky private servers that like sort of messed with gameplay and balance and power and like XP boosting and stuff. Like I played on what was called Blizz-like private servers for quite a long time. I don't think I'm going to go back to one of those either, because that's basically just playing classic. But what interests me, and this sort of is entirely dependent on me finding a group of people that would like to do it, is just slowly progressing through dungeon runs, like running 5-man dungeons, like even if I'm setting up my own private server again, because I also ran one way back in the day for a while, just to do dungeons at my own pace and then progress through the expansions, do the 5-mans. There is a server out there called TBC 5-man that has experimented with, and I haven't played on it, so I don't know how well it's executed, but taking the raids from Burning Crusade and rebalancing them and tuning them to run as a 5-man party as well. I have zero interest in like raiding with a large group. Honestly, by the time I really got out of raiding in WoW, even 10-man raids was just like, this is too many people. I don't want to deal with the bullshit. But the 5-man dungeons, if I wasn't doing it with like random dungeon finder stuff, if I just had a crew, like approaching it like I would approach Dungeons and Dragons, basically, not the role playing, but let's just roll through a couple of these tonight for a couple hours, shut it off, and we'll come back in a week or two. That idea kind of appeals to me.
Yeah, it appeals to me too. I mean, like, it's almost like thinking like Diablo 4 group play kind of deal, right?
Yeah, but WoW, like, you know.
Or sorry, Diablo 3. I haven't played Diablo 4
yet.
Yeah, I get it. I don't, like, I'm down for it. I don't know that I'm enthusiastic about it, just because, like, the WoW style of play is like, I don't know. It just doesn't appeal to me all that much.
That's kind of why this idea appeals to me, because A, You're not trying to keep up with a server, right? Like, literally, if I were setting it up as my own private server, we would be the only ones playing on it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no keeping up with the Joneses. There's no the bullshit of randos. Like, you know, 5 people log in, they run some dungeons the way they want to run them, and they leave. And I know that you've got some things about how instances and dungeons work in World of Warcraft that don't quite resonate the same way with, you know, the stuff that you like, and that's totally fair. But that would be a way to play WoW, at least for me, that doesn't involve all the baggage and bullshit that turned me off of WoW to begin with.
Yeah, the other people. It's like, I love the fact that it's an MMO, but you know what? It'd be really great if it was like an SMO.
Yeah. And, you know, don't treat this like a recruiting pitch kind of thing. Like, I'm really only talking about it to say, hey, I had the itch and I never thought I would again. It'll probably pass when I realize I don't have the time for this shit. Because yeah. I don't, you know, like, I could make it work. I could probably fit some stuff in. But I don't have time for this shit. But I had the itch. Like, my mind was like, I was at the point where I was ready to start compiling from source code.
You know what you should do is that you should just, like, you know, download your own map tool and like make your own framework for Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. That's almost the same, right?
Yeah. Fuck. It's a very, very similar kind of itch where it's like, this is a really cool idea. And it is a cool idea. Chances are, as you'd go the first time and like, how much time did this take? Man, I could have like cooked a pot of macaroni and watched a movie. And it would have been so much more fun.
Speaking of not having the time for stuff, one last video game thing I just want to say. 1.0 for Satisfactory dropped today as of the day of recording, September, what did you say it was, the 10th?
10th.
What year is it? 2024. Holy shit. Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
I don't know why that surprised me all of a sudden tonight.
Well, it was 2019, like last Tuesday. So,
yeah. So 1.0 dropped. It's been in early access for years. They've done the smart thing, and like the story, the narrative aspects of the gameplay never made it to early access. And, you know, it's at its core, it's still a factory builder game kind of thing. I've talked about it a few times. So it's not like a deep campaign. It's not like we're playing Horizon Forbidden West or anything. But they have dropped some story into the game that was only available when it was officially released. There's a whole new tier of technology. They've reworked a lot of stuff that looks super interesting. I think when I finish Horizon, I will dive back into probably my fourth attempted playthrough of that game.
Wow. It showed up. I got an email today that it was on my wish list and for sale. It's a little, just not quite in the budget right now, but it is something that is on my radar. So I will definitely give it a try.
Yeah, it's, I would say go into it blind if you can. You know, if you read about it too much, like, you know, everybody's, even my own pitch, like my own sort of, these are the things that I like about the game won't necessarily be the things that you would like and might turn you off. And if you just look up factory sims like Factorio and stuff, you'll just be like, you know, whatever. This feels like work. And to a certain extent, you know, Satisfactory might. But it sounds ludicrous to say that you would enjoy a game that involves making factories and optimizing them and managing them and planning them. And but let me tell you.
Man, I mean, I enjoyed the Sim games, like the original Sim games, like Sim City and Sim Ant and Sim Tower. I still really enjoy Bloons.
Yep.
Right, which is all about that kind of optimization.
Yep. The only thing more fun than building a factory in Satisfactory is tearing it down so you can build a better one, and then tearing that one down so you can build a better one.
Let's all tear down a factory.
All right. Hey, do you want to do some table talk?
We should do that. I failed.
You failed.
My world has collapsed. So we played our first game of our Sunday game since June. So it's been 4 months of... Hey, how about this weekend? Oh, I can't this weekend. Hey, how about Thursday? No, I can't this Thursday. Hey, how about this weekend?
We played a July. We had one game. July.
Yeah. Yes, we had a July. And it was very much a side quest.
Yeah.
And then I think we talked last week about how we lost a player. And then we played this Sunday to try and sort of wrap up the stuff that was in that side quest. And at the beginning of the session, I sort of put it to the group. We've lost a player. These characters were never really intended to be long-running characters. I assigned these characters with personality traits just to sort of push people a little bit outside of their comfort zone, just to try something new. My intention was, hey, we're going to play through this first little bit, this introductory sort of session, and then everybody's going to throw these characters away and make their own. And no one did. So we continued playing with those. And last night I said, like, listen, we've lost a player. It's been months since we played. Like every hook that I've put out there, you guys have already forgotten. So I'm going to have to reintroduce them anyway. Do we want to just like reset this thing and make new characters? And the consensus was almost immediately, I would say within the first 0.2 or 3 seconds, reset. So we are starting anew. And based on my time, mostly my energy levels, honestly, we're probably going to be running through some published modules just to take some of the you know labor off of me preparing all of the story.
So let's explore that, because I know like the main factor is time. I think you've probably found it challenging to build around nothing, essentially, right? Like,
yes.
Have you found your passion for the world building aspect? Like, do you consider that a failed experiment or do you?
No, I do not. I mean, I have like, I'm the island that you guys started on is not completely fleshed out, but there is an entire world of which that island is only a part that I only have sort of land masses and vague ideas of what's happening elsewhere. But I do want to continue to develop that. The trouble with that is that I think that that lends itself much better to doing sort of face-to-face stuff where there's a lot more. Because on online games, there's not a lot of back and forth about, hey, explain to me how this works, or what was this over here, or let me look at the map and see where that is, or who was that guy again? Mm-hmm. It does happen, but there's just less of it. So I'm probably going to start up an in-person game, and I'll do that in that setting. And most likely I will steal bits and pieces of the lore of, you know, the group that played through, and sort of introduce that as, hey, here are some heroes that did some things. But no, I still enjoy it.
Nice. The way I sort of look at the world building thing, whether it's the stuff you're doing, whether it's the stuff I'm doing, like, it's a big experiment, right?
It is.
When you look back at the experiment and how you approached it, and I sort of circling back to how when we originally kicked this off, we were going to try and work together, and we found that we have very different approaches.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not standing here saying that, like, yours was wrong and mine was right, because it's not the case at all. What I'm asking is, now that you sort of got through and experimented and actually played games, not just based on your approach to building the world, but the particular world that you built, do you think you would approach it differently, kicking it off again with a new person, both in the world building approach, but also like the lore that you've created? Like, would you change it much, or would you just build off of what you've already established?
I think I'd build mostly off of what I've already established. I think, though, that I would like to develop it a little bit more before I jump into it again. I looked at the Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide just as a sort of like what kind of things, you know, because I find a lot of times I look at published modules and I'm like, okay, there's a lot of stuff here and that's good, but it's not actually what I need to know. But a lot of the stuff that I need to know is stuff I'm going to improv anyway. So having that kind of like what that established lore is. And it's one of the things that I kind of approached when I asked you to just like kick me some seed ideas.
Yeah.
And that is like, here are some, the names of some heroes that are like, that feature in tales. Like, tell me names like Finn McCool and, you know, David and Goliath, or, you know, Helen of Troy, right? Those kinds of things where you don't necessarily, like, for the average person probably doesn't know a whole lot about, you know, Finn McCool, right? I've read a lot of Finn McCool stories. If you haven't ever heard of Finn McCool, go look it up. Some of the stories are really cool. But I don't have a lot of that available, right? So I'm improvising stuff that I should have written down in lore. So probably what I'll do is I'll go through something like the Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide, or like one of the 2E settings that I've got, and just make notes about, this is what I need to know, and have that, mm-hmm. right? Because I have some of it in my head, but there's not enough detail in order to present it in an adventure, right? Like, some of the things that I do still, the one thing that I still do want to explore is a world that does not have an established currency. just because, and I mean, it's, interestingly, I've been watching a fair bit of Dropout Humor, and Brennan Lee Mulligan, and mm-hmm. his anti-capitalist rants are like,
oh yeah,
I want to sit down and have a beer with this dude. Like, this is interesting. Like, he's so much better educated than I am. He's so much more eloquent than I am. I'm like, I want him to tell people why you can play D&D in a world that doesn't actually have money, right? It's not necessary. And I know that people were struggling with it a little bit, because I don't really have enough meat in that idea for people to latch onto, right? They're just going, well, I need to find some way to have money without having money, right? And I'm guilty of that as well, where it's like, okay, well, how do I reward people? Mm-hmm. Right. And there has to be some kind of a way to do that. Right. And I think it requires a little bit more creativity, because you can't just go, well, here's 10 gold pieces for killing the bandits. It's got to be like, all right, well, you know, you killed the bandits, you know, thank you very much. Let me present you with a homemade pie or whatever, you know. Anyway, yeah, I would continue with a lot of the same ideas. I think I would probably flesh out a bunch more details about who's where and what's there.
My world building very much has currency, and I'm not opposed to the idea of currency and not having it. I think it's an interesting thought exercise. I think for a tabletop game that doesn't have like that type of element, it probably needs to flesh out like a a reputation system of some pipe, because that becomes sort of the replacement for it. Either or, it's not like we, you know, there wasn't a shop that was providing items based on either reputation or tangible currency anyway. So, you know, it didn't really matter at the stage that we were at in that campaign.
I think that the idea, because there's a trope, right? Of like, okay, so today is a shopping session. Let's order pizza and I will get the book out and we'll barter back and forth about why the goblin doesn't have healing potions this week or whatever. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, so those can be some very, very fun sessions. But the idea that you're never going to have a shopping session, really, unless you go, hey, here's a market. But you know what? You need to find some way to barter for the thing, right? Like, hey, I want that fancy rug. Cool. I want a basket of apples. Okay, so you go talk to the apple seller. Well, I will give you a basket of apples if you, you know, you kill the rats in my basement or whatever. And it can be a whole chain of things.
Here's a sort of funny, maybe even slightly hypocritical admission. My campaign has money. Now, I don't award, you know, money like experience. Like, I'm completely sort of milestone mentality when it comes to how I run my games. I do, like, I'll sort of treat gold as that sort of reward for exploration sometimes. Oh, you find this vault. It's got some stuff in it. Even though my players collect money, gold, I've got sort of a like an iron bit system in this sort of Shadowfell city that we're kind of using as our hub right now. I don't do shopping, the traditional sort of shopping episodes where they're buying shit for themselves. Like, I don't sell gear. I don't sell potions. Part of that is I've been playing in settings that were at least starting off as kind of like low magic kind of settings. It wasn't like Waterdeep where you got wizards on every corner plying their wares and trades. But my party and my Tuesday game, like, they use money as a tool to sort of do narrative shit. Like, right now, they've spent a couple of sessions basically just in the streets, like, rallying the desperate and homeless people and trying to find people to sort of turn to their cause and sort of establish a... Basically, they're starting a revolution, so the currency kind of becomes a bit of a tool for doing that. I've had shopping episodes, but they're usually to support, like, weird, I don't want to say weird, interesting sort of, like, low-key side episodes, side sessions. So, you know, the most recent example is before they went in to try and... Because we were playing a player short for one session anyway, before they were trying to go into the streets and sort of rally people and start this revolution, they decided that, like, well, they're going to go out with food and stuff. So we basically had an entire episode that turned into, like, an episode of Chopped or, like, Iron Chef or something like that, where they spent time cooking. But to do it, they went into this market and they were just sort of snooping around trying to get info and looking for interesting ingredients they could find in the fucking Shadowfell. So, you know, it's like, oh, what do you want to make? Okay, well, you know, we don't have that here, but, like, here's this weird alternative. Like, do you want to milk some bugs? You know, so it just turned into this fun way of getting out and shopping, but it wasn't selling gear or items or progression type stuff. It was literally buying fucking bug milk.
Would you like some blue milk? You can drink it straight from the teat.
That they then took back to this bakery, which was sort of a building they'd inherited essentially from somebody they'd defeated, where they spent like an entire session figuring out, okay, well, what can we do with bug milk and weird shit to sort of make food? And then, you know, just through roles and skills and how do you want to juice it? And what do you want to do? You know, we're going to use your magic to try and make some really good food or whatever. It was a lot of fun. And that's kind of where my currency turns into a tool for, like, making that shit happen. And the currency very much is a tool for, like, establishing anti-capitalist sort of overarching tones in my games, not to the level that, like, Brennan Lee Mulligan does. I appreciate the extent that he goes to get his message across. Sometimes it's so overt that it's covert, and I really love that about him.
He is very talented. I'm having a little bit of trouble getting into the Calamity thing. I'm about, I don't know, it's a 4-hour episode, and I'm like, oh my God, there's how many of these?
Four.
And it's just, again, the time, right? It's because it's good. Like, it's like everybody's doing really, really well. And I love Sam's character and the fact that he's his ex-wife is oh, what's her name? She was the DM.
Abria Iyengar.
Yeah. And just like their interaction is just like, okay, these are two very talented improv people.
Yeah. The first episode is a bit of a, I don't want to say it's a slog, but it's a setup episode, right? Like,
it's very much introductory.
15 minutes on this character and nobody else at the table's talking. But you have to do that for something like that.
Yeah, because they are very much presenting as a show. That's one of the things actually I wanted to bring. There's six people sitting at that table. And for about 95% of a character's, like, this is my intro, everyone else is just sitting there paying attention. And that is so rare around an actual table.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed a lot of ums and ahs, which is not typical from the Critical Role sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Product,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, they're usually very good at, I'm just going to talk. There's not going to be any ums or ahs or pauses or whatever. And there's a little bit more, you can tell that this is a little bit more, I don't quite have as much background on what I'm trying to exposit here. Like, I'm making it up more out of whole cloth than usual.
Yeah.
Which is fine, right? It comes across more like we're playing D&D as opposed to we've been given a very big package about who our characters are and we've spent a bunch of time developing that.
I haven't been playing this character for 107 episodes before today. You know, this yes. is very much a, like, they, for those little mini sessions that they do, it's this weird thing because it is, you know, people accuse things like Critical Role of being scripted and they're not.
No, I think there's a little bit more prep than you would have for a typical D&D game, I think.
Well, and something like this, there's like, you know, there's a script in that, like, what has happened up until this point. Everybody agrees that when we start episode one, here's the established, not just the lore that the DM has created, but the relationships between the players. Like, I think that is a perfect example in getting back to us talking about restarting. One of the things that we mentioned after everybody jumped on the idea of starting fresh was, let's have a session zero, but let's do the character creation then and not just create characters, but create a party together.
Yes.
Right? Like, that's where you can really see, like, what makes some of that stuff so smooth for them, whether it's a side thing like Calamity or even just the first few episodes of a Critical Role campaign, is that they've done that. The characters have established relationships between each other sometimes. I know one of the things Matt Mercer will do before episode one is he'll run half the party through like an unrecorded episode just so they can work kinks out of things like voices. And, you know, these are the characters that have some established sort of history with each other. They'll run the other party members through their own little things so they can kind of work that out. So when they come together for that first session, and you have to do this more obviously because it's an actual play, it's a performance, it's a presentation, but I think some of that is super important. Learning from my own mistakes, especially, you know, this isn't a criticism of our players. I love all of our players, the people that have been in our games, whether they're there now or not. So this includes Chris, this includes Ian. Players in general can be sort of leaders and passengers, right?
Yep.
And I know part of the experiment when you kick this off was you're trying to change that dynamic. Let's take some of the people that tend to be a little bit more passengers, right? Not, I don't want to say that to say that they're not actively contributing to things, but they
tend to be followers rather than leaders.
Yeah. You put them in a position where they got to lead a little bit. And our group, I think, skews in that direction a little bit more, where it's just like, I just want something to be happening. Okay, well, what do you want to happen? I don't know. Make something happen. Right?
Yeah.
A little bit. And I think if we establish some of that stuff, like we build a party instead of like discrete characters, create even just a short history of like, here's your party up until this point, that will give us give those players a little bit more. They'll have their personal motivations, but ideally they also care about the other characters. That's the one thing, going back to what you mentioned about watching the Critical Role stuff, where everybody else around the table is paying attention.
It's because they're interested.
They're interested. They care, right? And that's not to say that other players don't care, but it is more common to have players sitting around a table that, like, they play the game when it's their turn.
Yes.
And then they stop playing the game when it's somebody else doing something. Like, you can be passively engaged in that, but you can also be actively engaged in that. And I think if you've somebody else's stuff is also your stuff, like, once that's all, and later in campaigns, like, I noticed that with my group on Tuesday, like, everything's so intertwined now that, like, one player's shit is never just their shit. Everything involves everybody else, but it took us a while to get to that point. This group very much started off as, like, discrete players kind of coming together with their own ideas of character, and they were, you know, it kicked off similar to how when I was running this similar campaign, similar setting with you. You've all received basically job offers, and you have a reason to show up to a certain place on a certain day. Other people are going to show up that you don't know.
Yeah. That's always been a major challenge for me as a DM is like, okay, so you got these players, how do they meet and why do they work together? Mm-hmm. And it's so much easier if you start off with, well, you've been working together for a while now. Tell me how.
Yep.
Right. And especially that's one of the things, again, and like going back to like the, you know, watching Ginny D and the advice that she gave, which she got from a book which she recommended, and I can't remember what it is, but I should buy it because it sounds great. Where it's like, ask the players, what do they want? Where are you? Put a little bit of the onus back on the group to say, okay, I'm telling you that you have all been working together for a while. You tell me as a group what you've done, why you're together, right? And what you want to do.
And that accomplishes a couple of things. A, it sort of establishes an individual character's reason for being there, forces them mm-hmm. to think about motivations, not just what you've been doing there, but why you're there. But it also forces you to align that shit a little bit with the rest of the party.
Yes.
You know?
Which is not to say that there won't be some chaotic elements and some people who are working at slight cross purposes.
No, absolutely not.
At very least, I mean, any group of friends is going to have like a couple of people who are like, you know what? I agree with you people on about 85% of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the other 15% of stuff, I think you're a moron and I'm not doing it.
That sounds like a healthy table to me.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it sounds like there's an awful lot of stuff that we can build off of when those like minor conflicts happen. It becomes interesting flavor for the story.
But you can't do that if every character is basically a blank slate. And not just, you know, how these characters in this campaign that you ran started, but most of the games that we run, it's been basically, well, you know, this is my character, this is their name, this is what they look like, this happened to me once in the past, and I'm here now. Okay.
And I'm Batman.
Yeah. That's the story equivalent of like a name tag, you know? That doesn't give you a lot to work with other than like, instead of saying, hey, stranger, I can say, hey, Bob, you're in my party, Bob.
My name is Legion. Yeah, I'll be interested to see, because we're doing this thing on Thursday evening. I'm interested to see how it goes. And I'm not prepping anything until I hear from people, because we're not playing on Sunday, I don't think. I think Cindy's actually going to be away this week.
Okay.
And I don't think we'll be playing the following Sunday, so I'll probably have to pick a day during the week, like 2 weeks out. And that gives me some time to prepare after having had the conversation with everybody about what do we want to do. Because if we want to like explore dungeons in the wild, I'm not going to run something in Waterdeep.
Yeah.
Right. And if we want to do something like city-based and like intrigue and solving mysteries or whatever, I'm not going to set up, you know, like friggin' Underdark or whatever.
You'll probably end up frustrated after Thursday night.
Almost certainly.
Because what you're going to get is, I'm cool with whatever. Or a balance of stuff is probably okay. You know? which tells you absolutely nothing. I think you need to commit to a basic setting. So, you know, Sword Coast doesn't need to be in Waterdeep. Yes. We're going to be playing in the Sword Coast. So you're going to establish this is what the basic sort of limitations are on character creation, right? You're going to be playing probably not a space cat.
Tabaxi exist on the Sword Coast.
Tabaxi do. Space cat with no ties to the world or the party. Harder to work with. Again, you could make it work, but the ideal situation is that you're not having to work so hard to make it work. You can always make it work, but that's you conceding to, all right, I'll figure it out.
Yes, I'm perfectly fine if you want to play as a, what is it, space fairy, what is it called? The ships that fly through space in D&D.
Spelljammers?
Spelljammer. Perfectly fine if you want to be an ex-spelljammer, but you need to have been here for a while and been working with the party for a while. We're not going to do the, you all meet in a tavern now, come up with a reason why you're together.
Yeah.
It's no, you've been together for a while because I want to start at level 5 just because, I mean, we can start at level 1 if people want. That's another thing that I'm going to sort of put to the party, right? Because if we are doing what I think we're doing, then there's a good sort of starting place at level 1. There's another reasonably good starting place at level 5, but it means that I'm going to have to do a bunch of exposition first. These are the things that have happened to you in the last few weeks. These are the people you've met. This is what's happened, and this is the problem. Now we're carrying on.
So from a timing perspective, you're going to run, I assume, the 2014 Player's Handbook, not the 2024, which comes out in a week.
Yeah, for now, it's the 2014. If there's something in the 2024 that you really want, because it's Rich does have it shared on his...
I noticed that. I was looking as like, well, I haven't got the PDF yet that I thought I was going to get. And I saw the link for D&D Beyond. And it's like, if I'm logged out, I don't have access to it. But if I'm logged in, I basically see everything. I can read the entire.
Yeah. Well, Rich has like basically bought the entire catalog and he shared it with us in that campaign. So it's there to look at. If there's something in there that you're really interested in, I mean, we'll probably have to house rule it in for Foundry, but.
With them officially partnering with them, I wouldn't be surprised that there's a day one sort of system drop for it.
I'm certain there will be. I am not certain that everything else will work with it. So there'll have to be some sort of fiddling about with that. Like, it will have to go to the like official D&D character sheets. We won't be able to use tidy sheets anymore. So on and so forth. All of that is just technical bullshit to work out. So have a look at it. If there's something in there, we're like, oh, I really love this. Then yeah, let's do that.
Yeah.
And if there's nothing, then 2014 is sort of the baseline.
Yeah. No, I'm fine with 2014 stuff. It's the shit I know. Fuck it. If you want to run Vampire the Masquerade, I'm cool with that too. Which again isn't super helpful, right? It's like I'm good to go. I'll do whatever everybody else wants to do.
If I was more familiar with the lore, I would actually love to run some cyberpunk, but once again, that's a whole bunch of reading that I have to do to get familiar with stuff. So we'll stick with the fantasy setting.
I've been enjoying, I'm in the middle of, well, actually, I'm almost wrapped up the Dimension 20 A Starstruck Odyssey one, which is based on the Starstruck comics that Brennan Lee Mulligan's mother actually co-created.
Okay.
But they're, as far as I know, they're using an Star Wars 5e.
Okay.
And I don't know how much they've sort of homebrewed and customized to fit the setting, but there's a lot of interesting sort of mechanics in it for stuff like not just necessarily ship combat, but ship functions. There's a lot of mechanics around lifestyle and income, and like you can literally upgrade your lifestyle to certain levels that have certain perks and, you know, from sleeping underneath the FTL drive to actually having a room of your own. And, you know, it's it's a lot of stuff piled on top of an already complex set of 5e mechanics, which is why I wasn't using something like that when I was doing my dive into the Mass Effect stuff. But now that I'm seeing somebody else play it, I'm like, okay, yeah, it's a lot of stuff, but most of it comes together in a way that feels pretty fun, I think, once you get it.
The 5e Star Wars set of things, from my experience, and it, which is very minimal, it felt really neat. Like there's a sort of like there's an extra set of dice that goes along with sort of your challenge dice or whatever it is, where like you roll this and yes, you succeed, but based on this and that and the other thing, it's like, you know, you actually fail forward at the task instead of succeeding at the task, or you succeed with like stellar effect, or like you very seldom actually fail at something. It's you get what you want, but there are consequences, right? And it's based on the roll of the dice rather than, right? There, I mean, there is a way to actually fail, but it's much less likely that, anyway, there's some interesting mechanics about success and failure in the system that I really liked.
Mm-hmm. Now, I haven't, and maybe it's something they omitted for the show. I haven't seen them use any of those types of mechanics. Like most of the basic sort of checks and whatnot have been very 5e with Star Wars, like cosplay.
You know? Okay.
And then stuff that relates to ships, there's a lot of like piloting checks and things that can happen there. There's specific tasks and stuff that you can have that are related to ship mechanics and abilities and stuff like that. But it's interesting because, like, whether it's purely the Star Wars 5e, which I've not looked into much, to be perfectly clear, so I don't know how much of that works versus like what I'm seeing, whether it's homebrew. There's interesting hacking mechanics. There's interesting sort of tech mechanics. Like it's built around a game that has droids in it and stuff like that. So what I've been seeing in the A Starstruck Odyssey has been a good demonstration of all of that stuff. And it's just looked really, really fun.
It would be. Space is fun, I've heard. I've never been. Well, are we out of table talk?
I think we're out of table talk, unless you have something else you want to talk about.
I can't believe that we ran out of table talk to talk about.
I mean, I could always fill the space with all sorts of things. Like, how much longer do I need to speak before you crack that bone shaker?
About an hour and a half.
I can do it. Buckle up.
Oh my God, he's got the telephone book out and he's reading it. I was gonna say something, I forgot. At the beginning of this episode, before we actually hit the record button, you're like, do we even want to talk about this? I don't know if there's anything to talk about. And then we went for like a half hour.
No, it was more or less I didn't know what you wanted to talk about. Not that I thought you'd be sensitive about the idea that campaign you were running is kind of, we've hit the reset button on it, but I don't know how much you want to.
It's been clear for a little bit that it was kind of a lame duck, and I get it, right? Like, there's not a lot of lore for anyone to lean on, and I knew that our particular group is not big into, like, I want to improvise how the world works. Which is kind of an interesting departure, because when Cindy first started playing D&D, like, she was just making shit up all over the place. And some of it was just absolute gold, and some of it was like, no, you just can't do that, right? Like, we would walk into a new town and she'd go, I'd go visit my sister because she lives, you know, in that little hut over there and she grows mushrooms for a living. And I'm like, okay. Right, because I can weave that in. That's fine, right?
Cindy, this is your 17th sister that we've run into in this campaign.
I don't think any of them are actual sisters. I think she belongs to some kind of a cult.
Best I can figure, you've established the largest intelligence network in the entire world.
She was playing a rogue at the time, so it's entirely possible. Anyway, yeah, I think we're out of tabletop stuff that's, you know, of interest to our three listeners. Maybe four now.
Well, we might as well wrap it up then and get into some parting gifts.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Anybody want a peanut?
So I mentioned I'm not sure on the podcast, but I'm deeply embedded in the YouTube algorithm now because I've been flipping through shorts. And there's a guy on there. I think he mostly does his stuff on TikTok, but he does have YouTube shorts and he has a YouTube channel, and he's a performer at Renaissance festivals in the US called Jack Zwipper. Apparently he ran away as a kid to join the circus. So now he has like a sort of whip cracking show, but the stuff that he posts on TikTok is typically him sort of improvising made up lyrics to songs that people shout out while he beats the whip or he cracks the beat on his whips. And it's very entertaining. It's more entertaining than it has any right to be. I mean, his shtick should be boring and pedantic, but it isn't. So I entirely put that down to how much talent he's got. I think he's getting reasonably famous now on the internet for cracking whips. So good on him. Check it out, Jack Zwipper. He's worth a watch.
Not my turn this week, but I think I want to slip one in.
Go for it.
Normally we alternate, but...
I've bogarted the last four, I think.
Fuck it, so I'm going to slip one in. I haven't hidden the fact that, like, I'm an old man now, and I've been watching a lot of, like, woodworking YouTube and stuff. And I finally stumbled across a channel that, like, it's actually a fairly popular channel. A lot of the woodworker guys that I do watch talk about this guy fairly often. The channel's called Blacktail Studio. And what's sort of interesting about this guy, I mean, he does beautiful stuff, but like almost everything that he makes is the same. And I don't mean that in a negative way, just like to contrast it to some of the other woodworkers who are always trying to build new and different things and like have something that feels fresh every week, right? Or however often they publish videos. This guy specializes in doing like tables, epoxy tables, like, you know, he's always using stuff like various walnuts and burls. And so the process, like most videos that he does follow basic formula. I consume it almost like ASMR type stuff. Like I watch it before bed, one or two of them. It just helps me unwind and relax. I'm not focused so much on the crafting and the woodworking. I'm not trying to learn much from it. Where a lot of the other woodworking channels that I do watch, I'm trying to like learn stuff, even if I don't have a shop myself. I'm always paying attention to stuff and learning things. I just like turn my brain off and watch this guy do his thing. He's great in that, like, he'll show his failures and but everything that he's doing, like it's a $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 table by the time he's done. Sells this shit, makes it for clients. It is his little niche and every video is like that. And it's just mesmerizing. He does commentary during the entire thing, but you can almost enjoy it without the commentary. Just watching him, you know, there's no surprises. Like you see what's coming. There's no major, he does some deviate from the formula. Like he'll do neat things like try and make a table out of denim.
Which is a neat idea.
Well, once you get like dabbling with resins and stuff like that, like, I mean, it's, you can be super creative, but most of the stuff that he does is just like really quality, like walnut stuff that he's, you know, a lot of live edge stuff, a lot of stuff that's cracked and split and burled, and he's having to fill with epoxy. Like it isn't that he's making sort of resin tables. It's taking this natural, ugly but beautiful piece of wood and turning it into something that is both artistic and beautiful, but also functional. Blacktail Studios. Cam's awesome. He's got more than 1 million followers. Like he doesn't need our help plugging him or anything, but.
Yeah, but it's nice to share these things. It's nice to watch someone who's just good at their craft be crafty.
Well, it's been good talking to you, man.
And you, I mean, we probably went over time and did a whole bunch of digressions we didn't need, but that's what the show is. All right, I'm going to crack open this bone shaker.
okay, well, I'm going to watch you drink it and die a little on the inside.